Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Vulnerabilities Podcast, where we discuss those segments of society that need us the most. As always, I have here with me Ms. Marbi Maiman, a former social protection minister from Pakistan, twice parliamentarian, and foremost an international humanitarian. Today, we will be discussing the issue of financial inclusion. Now, ensuring the financial inclusion of the vulnerable into systematic registries to facilitate poverty alleviation is crucial. We will look at the determinants and effects of financial inclusion and also how a lack of such systems presents a global challenge. We will see how financial inclusion exacerbates existing vulnerabilities whilst also creating new ones and highlight what is being done globally to facilitate financial empowerment. Ms. Maiman has first-hand experience dealing with the issue of financial inclusion, so her insight will no doubt be extremely significant today. As Social Safety Minister, she led Pakistan's largest social safety net, which facilitated the financial inclusion of 6 million vulnerable people and their families. The success of this incredible program actually also resulted in her receiving the House of Commons Speaker Inaugural Democracy Award in 2017. In fact, BISP has been at the forefront of financial inclusion, showcasing both domestically and internationally. During her time in government, Ms. Maiman received domestic awards on financial inclusion and also hosted the UN Secretary General's Special Advocate for Inclusive Finance for Development, Queen Maxima of the Netherlands, in 2016. BISP continues to be showcased as the largest financial inclusion program for Pakistan by the UN even to date. Ms. Maiman has been championing the cause of financial inclusion since and has spoken at numerous events both within Pakistan and in Europe, highlighting the centrality of financial inclusion to the global poverty alleviation agenda. Ms. Maiman, welcome to today's podcast on vulnerabilities. Let me just start by asking you to explain to our listeners the link between financial inclusion and vulnerability.
Thank you, Laila. I have seen this very closely when I led Pakistan's social safety net called BISP. Simply put, by including the vulnerable in a safety net by giving them cash handouts through the banking system, we financially included them and we helped them exit chronic poverty at the time. And let us start at the very beginning. What is financial inclusion? What does one mean by the term? According to the World Bank definition, which is always the standard useful one in our development debate, financial inclusion means, I quote, that individuals and businesses have access to useful and affordable financial products and services that meet their needs, transactions, payments, savings, credit, and insurance, delivered in a responsible and sustainable way. So, Laila, it essentially refers to the availability of or access to banking services. Now, financial inclusion is central to the reduction of poverty and facilitating economic growth. But at the most basic level, financial inclusion exacerbates poverty and hinders the development of economies. In the social safety net example, when millions are excluded from safety nets, and as a consequence from banking systems, one can well imagine how poverty indicators get worsened. Financial inclusion facilitates day-to-day living. It helps one prepare for the future and also for unexpected shocks, like pandemics also. So really, if you look at the absence of financial inclusion, it increases uncertainty. It prevents one from being prepared to deal with risks and unexpected incidents, for example, job loss, medical emergencies, etc. And the current debate is centered around a pervasive problem faced by the world today, which is the disconnect between income and consumption. Consumption smoothing is a concept used to show the human being's desire to have a stable consumption pattern, one which creates balance between spending and saving. Modern banking and financial systems help us with consumption smoothing. Insurance helps us deal with the unexpected financial losses of perhaps car crashes, sharp increases, business expenses. It can be assisted with loans. Keeping savings in a bank rather than at home can facilitate future savings at interest as interest accrues. So, especially in the middle of climate change, conflict, and pandemics, financial exclusion is indeed a curse for the vulnerable from which they bleed versus they recover.
And what determines financial exclusion?
So the determinants of financial inclusion are both supply side, that is inefficiencies, inadequacies of the banking financial system, and demand side, that is the capabilities and preferences of the customer. Much of the financial exclusion is the result of the inability of commercial financial providers to supply a wide array of services which meet the needs of customers from all sections of society. Those who may not possess insurance or have poor credit histories tend to face financial exclusion. If this is the case, it then becomes very difficult for such customers to improve their financial profiles and secure their futures. So as you can see, it's cyclical in that sense. Low incomes also lead to financial exclusion, as customers may be either unable to afford financial services or may be priced out of these services. Those who are reliant on benefits or have low cash in hand jobs often fall into the low income brackets. This makes such profiles less desirable to banks, increasing the likelihood of their financial exclusion. Financial institutions are more interested in those customers that are considered low risk. This tends to stop those who need the financial assistance or services the most, that is, obviously, the most vulnerable. It's interesting to note, Lila, that financial exclusion and social exclusion go hand in hand. Social exclusion almost always leads to financial exclusion, and financial exclusion only serves to reinforce existing social inequalities. For example, migrants or refugees often face social exclusion and are also afforded less access to services, including financial ones. This is also why women, especially rural women, are especially vulnerable when it comes to financial exclusion. There are, of course, infrastructural factors which also perpetuate financial exclusion. These hinder or limit access to financial services. For instance, communication facilities, roads, working mobile networks, internet connections, et cetera, especially as more and more banks look to go paperless, those who do not have an internet presence or access stop such networks are more vulnerable to financial exclusion. This is exactly why financial exclusion is more of a problem in rural areas, developing countries, and poorer communities and conflict areas. And on the demand side, we must consider behavioral factors which contribute to financial exclusion. These determine a customer's willingness to engage with financial services. This includes perhaps a lack of awareness about the need to plan and prepare for the future, inadequate financial knowledge, lack of consumer trust in banking services.
Okay, and what about some of the effects of financial exclusion?
Okay, so financial exclusion really makes vulnerability, you know, it increases vulnerabilities, makes populations more susceptible to risks and uncertainties. And financial exclusion can perpetuate exclusion from other services, such as savings, pension schemes, can therefore increase the risk of debt. Without financial inclusion, access to short-term credit becomes problematic, and people are increasingly reliant on loan sharks and other borrowing agents with extremely high rates of interest. Financial exclusion can also hinder those seeking employment, as many companies choose to pay employees solely through electronic transfers. It also makes one less able to face financial shocks and unexpected expenses because they may not have savings nor access to loans. And financial inclusion exacerbates both income inequality and poverty, which is why for social safety nets, this is the reason why, you know, they're brought into the banking system so that we manage poverty better with the help of banking accounts for the poor. And studies have shown that financial exclusion has often led people to isolate themselves because of a feeling of, you know, embarrassment which accompanies it if they don't have access to all of these products and services, etc.
So if one was to turn towards setting up of social safety nets, how does having a good registry of households within a safety net positively impact financial inclusion? How is it connected to the problem of vulnerability then?
Okay, so complete detailed registries of households are central to financial empowerment, equal financial opportunities, and the eradication of poverty. I can't overstress the importance of this. I mean, this is critical, crucial, especially in the developing world, in conflict zones, etc. Without detailed registries, you cannot plan, you cannot include them in the financial system, you cannot service them in any way. So that is the number one objective, should be the number one objective. And unfortunately, even in developing countries which have a lot of experience, these registries are often they're not updated as much as they should be. And they're not kept updated, which then doesn't help that country get out of poverty as such. Now, what we mean by registration in national household registries here is the creation of databases which store essential information needed not only to track income levels, financial activity, and poverty rates, but which are also crucial for inclusion within financial systems, both for giving cash handouts and for giving graduation programs from poverty, like microfinance, for example. A large determinant of global financial inclusion are the barriers to entry. A major barrier to entry is a lack of documentation of who the poor are, where they are, what they do, how they live, and how they survive. That's how financial exclusion and registration are connected. The minute you have the demographics, you can connect them to the financial system. In essence, the vulnerable need an ID, an identification within the state. They need to be visible on some radar of the state. Without an ID, they are invisible and they cannot be helped out of their vulnerabilities. Without a household registration identification, it is not possible to include them within the financial system. So especially in conflict zones, fragile state, there tends to be either inefficient or no household registration or safety nets in place. The strengthening of such ID systems as step one is critical if the vulnerable are to be ever financially completely empowered.
Okay. And as I understand, your book, Gender Pakistan and UN Peacekeeping, actually delves quite deep into this process of registration of the vulnerable. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Certainly. The book focuses on conflict zones and UN peacekeeping missions. There's, of course, the emphasis on gender, which means that it automatically is considering the needs of the most vulnerable, which is perfect for the purpose of our discussion in today's podcast. Essentially, what I've noted in the book was that although conflict zones contain some of the highest proportions of vulnerable people, they also have the most inadequate facilities to empower them. In this case, I was looking at their financial empowerment. And as part of a gender-responsive agenda I proposed in the book, I noted that in the inclusion of gender data management through household registries was essential. You mentioned Queen Maxima, the UN Secretary General's Special Advocate for Financial Inclusion earlier, and then this is in particular actually resonates strongly with UN's Financial Inclusion Target Strategy that is led by her. And I want to quote her. She says, to close the gender gap in financial inclusion, we need policies based on evidence and data on women's financial inclusion. Getting high-quality, gender-disaggregated data can truly help policymakers make this happen, close quotes. So we can see that the framework promoted by the UN quite clearly highlights the link between financial inclusion and gender. And this is of special significance to me, given my work whilst I led this. Just to get back to those registries, Laila, in addition to the basic requirements such as name, location, number of family members, and other details required for comprehensive registries, you, of course, need information on the level of education attained by the family members, disabilities or health problems, income data, including the type of employment, what sector, what occupation, number of hours worked per week, etc., etc. Occupancy details, including whether a home is owned, rented, what material is it made of, how many rooms it entails, and all the details of the actual living conditions, sources of drinking water, electricity availability, gas. So, I mean, it's very detailed. And I would say, based on my experience, a good information data set should have at least 60 of these questions and 60 data points as such, which then make a very strong, robust household registry, which can be very, very useful for financial inclusion and poverty management at the same time. What this does is that it ensures vulnerable people are identified and registered into the system. This allows one to create a poverty scorecard, which is then should be routinely updated as and when one's details change. And such registration systems are so comprehensive that it becomes quite easy to point out specific vulnerabilities and target them and consequently, address them. And this makes for more equitable resource and service allocation, inclusion in development programs, and also helps calculate eligibility for other initiatives such as microfinance programs. It also gets rid of the duplications in the system. So if they're registered in one program, should they be eligible for another, et cetera, et cetera. And effective registration, such as the detailed above, the example I've given, can also facilitate financial inclusion, especially in fragile states. It's because through such registries, one is not only included in a standardized database, but relevant information such as occupation, income, living situation, dependence is all readily available. It therefore reduces some of the barriers to entry that we had earlier mentioned, if you remember.
Yes, for sure. So given your experience both on the ground and with respect to research, which parts of the world would you say face the highest rates of financial exclusion?
Out of the 4.2 billion working adults, about 2.3 billion are unbanked. So goes as far as the statistics are concerned. Of course, simply being unbanked is not the be-all and end-all of financial exclusion, but it does paint a clear enough picture to grasp the severity of the situation. Now, the World Bank has estimated that Asia itself holds more than 1 billion unbanked people. I mean, that's pretty high. And the most populous countries in the region, China and India, hold about 225 million and 190 million financially excluded people, respectively. The geographical distribution of the financially excluded is definitely concentrated in Asia, with China, India, Indonesia, and Bangladesh holding roughly one third of the global total. Sub-Saharan Africa, Laila, is another region with extremely high rates of financial exclusion. Women also make up a large proportion of the world's unbanked populations. Around 56% of the financially excluded are women. This trend is especially staggering in Asia, where women comprise 60% of unbanked adults in China and India. And the same can be seen in Bangladesh, where 65% of the unbanked population comprises of women. So there are a few obvious connections one can make. Firstly, more populous countries have higher rates of financial inclusion, irrespective of how large or developed their economies are, And second, there's a clear link to gender, which necessitates a much larger conversation about gender inequality as such.
So just to focus on Asia, because you mentioned the rates are quite staggering there, have any of the governments of these Asian countries managed to improve, if not overturn, these trends?
Definitely. I can't say they've been overturned, but there's definitely been improvement and there's some success stories. Let's take Indonesia, for example, where the account ownership amongst adults more than doubled between 2011 and 2017. At the same time, female financial inclusion rose from below 20% to above 50%. Similarly, Malaysia now holds a population where 85% are financially included compared to 66% in 2000. Malaysia has truly seen impressive improvement. Bank Negara Malaysia has done some brilliant work on financial inclusion, for instance, through microfinance programs. They even had the Woman Entrepreneur Financing Program, which was geared specifically towards improving women's financial inclusion. Pakistan, with its chronically poor, has ID'd and financially banked about more than 6 million of the chronic poor. And we've also got a similar women entrepreneurship program that when I was leading the BISP, we had launched at the time, and it's still ongoing and it's still giving good returns to the government. The list is long, as each country, frankly, Laila, is being tracked for these indicator improvements. Of course, we can't go into each country, but I've just given you 2-3 examples here.
So that was Asia. So what would you say, in what ways does the issue of financial inclusion come to pose a global challenge for the entire international community?
So the issue of financial inclusion has definitely moved up the ladder in the international reform agenda. And this isn't solely because of this isolated issue, but it's also because of how closely financial inclusion is linked to other development and poverty eradication goals of the international community. The implications of financial inclusion are so far-reaching. They affect poverty alleviation, gender equality, female empowerment, financial stability, income equality, and inclusive economic growth, to name but a few. This is why it has become crucial to the global development agenda, as well as part of the national action plans of individual UN member states. And it's being tracked for most of these states by the UN. So for example, because poverty eradication is such a cornerstone of the International 2030 agenda, World Bank goal to end extreme poverty by 2030, financial exclusion really has come to the forefront of international planning. And like I said earlier, that we've got a special UN advocate of the UN Secretary General on it as well. So that shows you the kind of focus there is. World Bank, for example, aims to raise the shared prosperity of the lowest 40% of the populations of each country by reducing income inequality. This too is interlinked heavily with financial inclusion. And gender inequality and female empowerment has also come to the forefront of the UN SDGs. And financial inclusion has ascended up the priority list with that as well. So as you can see, financial inclusion is a path which can help facilitate the international community's goals for a sustainable and equitable future for sure.
So just given your immense kind of experience with this issue on the ground, what are some of the approaches you feel that could alleviate the vulnerabilities of the financially excluded more effectively?
Yeah, so we've talked about the registry to start off with. That's a basic step. And after that, I want to mention the graduation programs. The aim really is to reach a new range of customers with a new range of products which suit their specific needs, socioeconomic status, and their capabilities. Other than cash handouts, which we've discussed through social safety nets, which can be conditional or unconditional, there are two methods in particular which I want to talk about today. First, I want to talk about microfinance. And second, I want to talk about e-commerce, the two that I have personally introduced and I've seen the results. And they're working to date, at least in Pakistan and in many other countries. Microfinance services are created especially to reach those who are excluded from mainstream financial services. They're designed to reach those who are socially marginalized and geographically isolated. The aim is self-sufficiency. These programs include microcredit, small loans for chronically poor clients, saving accounts, checking accounts, microinsurance, etc. These programs are crucial for poverty reduction and for inclusion, financial inclusion. And if you look at the best experience, I want to talk about three products that we started and which have given good impact evaluations after that. The first was the simplest. And this is a small loan program whereby a certain poverty category of the vulnerable were given small loans to start small businesses. Of course, their selection was through the household registry based on certain poverty scorecard indicators. And they were all financially included and all banked. The second was a business incubation and asset transfer for self-employment model, the BISE. And this entailed a micro-investment plan for each selected household, transfer of an asset to start economic activities, provision of income-generating grants, and inclusion in a savings scheme and health insurance. So as you can see, very comprehensive. The third was direct cash with business coaching for startups. And I would say, Laila, a combination of these three graduation programs was used on the chronically poor and has continued as practice to be used. So it's really a combination, not just one of these programs. The results so far are encouraging, and they're weaning out the dependency factor of the cash grants, which is really something that we have all been working towards in the development sector. Now, the second one that I mentioned was e-commerce. I'm a big fan of e-commerce. I've seen the results, and especially since there are many areas which are excluded if there is no e-commerce. E-commerce becomes very important for those geographical locations which are not so connected to cities, etc. Now, the use of e-commerce promises to include the otherwise marginalized into the financial system. This is simply because e-commerce addresses the problem of the proximity to market issue for the vulnerable in the most cost-efficient way. The vulnerable could be on top of a remote mountain with no access to world markets, but through the internet and by creating products of international appeal, they can directly sell anywhere in the world. So the buyer and sellers are linked without the need for any middlemen or massive infrastructure other than basic internet and phone technology. Its powers have only been tapped into. So what the world is experiencing in terms of eradicating vulnerabilities through e-commerce is only the tip of the iceberg, Laila. There's so many opportunities. It's limitless. This is like huge. I've actually addressed this in my last book on peacekeeping, where the e-commerce was noted as crucial to female financial inclusion, especially in conflict zones. And especially in such fragile environments, because transport, communication, and access are hindered by conflict, capitalizing on such technologies is an efficient way to use the skills and talents of the marginalized to create marketable products. E-commerce can be of use even outside conflict zones. The use of such innovative technologies creates an enabling environment for financial inclusion by giving people an online presence. It has been internationally recognized as a tool of financial inclusion and especially important to address the gender disparity within this. Now, during my time leading the social safety net, we were successfully able to link the vulnerable women for a specific e-commerce project, which at the time was we were selling embroidered shawls from all across Pakistan from the smallest villages, remotest villages. The idea was simple because in this case, the skills to create those shawls were something the vulnerable did not need any training for. They were kind of born with it. It was like culture, tradition, they had been given that skill. And thus, the cost to integrate them into the financial inclusive e-commerce world were relatively low. So you need to find such products, I mean, which makes sense for all these specific markets. Like I said, it's market specific. There are many other climate smart technologies which can also be sold through e-commerce, which can exit the vulnerable out of poverty. And we've discussed this in the last podcast for climate change, if the, our listeners have heard that. Case studies have shown that e-commerce technologies are especially helpful in including rural women into the financial force. So for example, in Bangladesh in 2017, the e-commerce market grew 127% in urban areas and 167% in rural areas. So the potential and popularity are clear. I mean, you can see that.
I'd love to get your opinion on this. Just given that we're living through a pandemic, how do you think these kinds of strategies would fare given the current COVID-19 crisis?
Yeah, I think COVID has exacerbated the urgency with which we need more adequate financial inclusion. Small businesses and already vulnerable populations have been adversely affected. It's that much more important to be able to offer them some semblance of certainty amidst the chaos that they're living through. The same goes for e-commerce. I think COVID pushed a lot of people to create an online presence for themselves and their small businesses. So many people who were not even involved in any business kind of created one for themselves using online platforms. And I think that really is useful going forward. We see more and more how everything is shifting online, and we need to ensure that the otherwise excluded are brought along on this particular shift. I was reading a very interesting article from the IMF recently, and I just like to end this particular podcast with it because it captures the essence of what we were trying to truly capture in this podcast today. So I quote, "The pandemic shows that greater digitalization of financial services is here to stay. To build inclusive societies and address rising inequalities during and after the ongoing crisis, global and national leaders must close the digital divide across and within countries to reap the benefits of digital financial services." I think, Laila, that pretty much says quite a bit that we have been talking about today.
Definitely. I think that's an extremely apt way to end. Thank you so much, Ms. Maimon, for such an insightful conversation on an issue which is seeming increasingly relevant as we live through the pandemic. Like you said, small businesses suffer and the poor get that much more vulnerable. There's clearly an urgent need to prioritize financial inclusion within national, regional, and international policy frameworks. So I hope this episode has been informative, not only in terms of getting across the urgency of the problem, but also in terms of your experience on the ground and the valuable insight you've offered us today in terms of solid, clear-cut policy proposals. So I'd like to thank our listeners as well for staying with us, and I look forward to welcoming them soon for another episode of the Vulnerabilities Podcast.